Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is novelist Elena Maria Viramontes. Viramontes is a professor in the English department at Cornell University. She is the recipient of several awards, including the John Dos Passos Award for Literature and a fellowship at the Sundance Institute. She's the author of the highly acclaimed Under the Feet of Jesus and her most recent powerful novel, Their Dogs Came With Them, published by Aitra Books. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, you were born and raised in East Los Angeles in what you described as a home without books. So how did you discover literature?
Well, you know, back in 1965, my father bought a set of World Book encyclopedias. And to this day, we still have them there at my father's house. My mother's passed, my father's passed, but there they are on the shelf. And I remember as a child, my father had put them up on the buffet in the living room, like sacred, you know, objects. And, you know, we were not allowed to touch them because they weren't paid for. So, I mean, just, you know, I was dying to look at these books, and I would just get whatever volume was there and just pull it out and run to the bathroom, lock the door, and read. And so that's what I did until, of course, I got a card to the public library, and then that was a different story. But it was the encyclopedia that really influenced myself as a writer, because I thought that this set of books had all the information in the world that I ever wanted to know. And then on the other side of that, I had my sister's Bible, and she kept it in her underwear drawer. And her fiancé at the time was in Vietnam. And so she would get a lot of solace from reading the Bible and then putting it in her drawer and, you know, then going to sleep at night. And I would literally pick the Bible up, read the parables, put it back so that she didn't know that I was touching her stuff, and then retell the parables to my younger sisters and my brother. Those two influences, the encyclopedias, the Bible, and also, you know, the storytelling that went on in the house.
So there was a lot of storytelling. Well, I was wondering how that segued into you wanting to start writing yourself.
Well, let me tell you, I mean, I think we're all born with the capability and the capacity to tell stories, because we're all born with this incredible curiosity about other people's lives. I mean, I see it all the time in children. As soon as children, you begin to talk to them about certain things, their ears and eyes will perk up and they'll listen to you. And somehow we lose that somewhere along the line as we grow up. And that's why it's important when we begin to write, or when we begin to really think about doing writing, that we begin to revisit ourselves as children. And I, you know, that's why I think that 60% of the new novels, first novels, are coming of age novels. You know, they deal with this, you know, a certain, an incredible certain passage from childhood to adulthood. I wouldn't guess otherwise, because childhood is so essential. You know?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, you went to Immaculate Heart College, and you said you were influenced by radical feminist nuns. Now, I've never heard those two words in front of the word nuns. Tell us.
Oh, bless their hearts. Let me tell you, they were incredible. There were also non-nuns who were teaching at the time, but Immaculate Heart College found themselves with a certain theory of liberation where they really felt that they should work towards the teachings of the true Christ. And when I say that, I'm talking about working with people who were poverty-stricken or working towards social injustice. And so every class that I took always had a mixture of religion, philosophy, of creativity, but they always challenged us. They always reminded us over and over again that we would be the citizens of the world and that we needed to know certain things, and we needed to know these certain things so that we could make decisions 10 years down the line. Like, I remember taking an ethics class where we talked about test tube babies, where we talk about abortion issues. This was in 1971.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. It was amazing. And of course, I just, you know, I went nuts. I mean, I went nuts so much that I actually finished my undergraduate degree in 3.5 years, working 20 hours a week.
You got totally into it.
I got totally into it. They still continue to do work in the community, though the college itself, of course, became defunct How could it not be? It was so incredibly radical that it did become defunct. And in fact, the buildings were sold to the American Film Institute. Huh? And that's where the American Film Institute is housed.
Uh-huh. Now, much of your writing, but both your novels and your stories, are focused on women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you feel, was this a conscious decision to bring visibility to this pretty invisible culture?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, that it's so interesting. When I was an undergraduate and an English major, the novels that I would read, the stories that I would read, never had stories about me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or about my family, or about my mother. You know, I remember when my mother used to work, Fridays were laundry day. We used to get up in the morning about 7 o'clock and smell the bleach, get up, have breakfast, go to school, come home, and she was still washing.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, these laundry days, she did that on Friday. On Saturday, she did the ironing. I mean, the incredible amount of work that she did. And I remember from a very early age on, as a child, I really had that sense of what was right and what was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember when I was 5 years old, and my job was to sweep the driveway of our house. You know, we had a heavy, female-heavy household. I had 6 sisters and 3 brothers. And so the females, of course, as soon as they could hold the broom, a dust mop, whatever, they were given the chores to clean the house and help my mother out. But my brothers, of course, would have the privilege of doing whatever they wanted to do. And I remember as a child standing there with the broom and looking at this driveway, which to me at that time must have looked like a runway. Mm. It was so huge. And my brothers were going off to play football or stickball. And I remember standing there saying, this isn't fair. This isn't fair. So that sense of it being not fair is something that just slowly accumulated in me. So when I saw my mother and the work that she did, and then saw my aunts, you know, and other women like them, I realized that nobody is recognizing them.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is giving them the honor that they need or that they deserve as women who come here, who nurture, who love, who build, and nobody gives them 10 minutes of their time.
Yeah, that's right.
I decided, you know what, this is exactly what I want to do. My first story that I ever wrote, it started off with my mother and my father. You know, so I was very, very determined to get their voices out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I started out, I mean, I only had one creative writing class with Eloise Klein Healy, who's now this incredible poet in Los Angeles, but at that time, a fairly young instructor. That was the only creative writing I had as an undergraduate, and it was then that I wrote my first short story, and then I went on to work at the Pabst Blue Ribbon Brewery because I couldn't find a job with an English major. I mean, I couldn't find with an English degree. Who
I
wanted?
Think some people still have that problem, Elena.
You know, they kept asking me, "Do you type?" You know.
Now, before we do run out of time, I do want to talk a bit about your book, Their Dogs Came With Them, an incredibly powerful novel, and this also takes us through several women's lives in the barrios of East Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s. Tell us about these characters. Are they autobiographical?
You know, I would make the general assumption that every character has a seed that belongs to us and that we push, and then we push out, and then, of course, we begin to allow that character to grow onto themselves. And then once that happens, let me tell you, it's a liberation for us writers and also an incredible amount of enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
These characters, though, and if you notice, Tish, there's approximately 25 of them.
There are 4 main women characters that stream through the book.
And it's interesting to note them. I mean, you know, Ermila is somebody who... she's just a lot more feisty than I ever was at that age, let me tell you, and sexually active at the time. You have Anna, which is a little bit more like myself and my experience with taking care of my own brother who had a schizophrenic disorder and the frustrations and the cost, the human cost, and the lack of understanding that people with schizophrenic disorders have.
Mm.
And so, you know... And Tranquilina, who's the minister, was somebody who I really had to create just out of the clear blue. She is really somebody who I don't really know, who I didn't know until she became layer after layer of writing her out into a full character.
And Turtle.
Oh,
Turtle is an amazing character.
Yeah, she's a very interesting character. I think, every time I used to write her section, it was the hardest. It was always the hardest for me to write.
Tell people who she is a little
bit. She's an androgynous gang member who loves her brother very much, and her identity is closely tied to her brother, and both her and her brother belong to this gang. And when her brother is drafted, remember the novel takes place between 1960 and 1970, when her brother gets drafted, she is alone and decides to AWOL. She's just tired of the gang life, but realizes there's no network of where she can fall. I mean, she really has no friends. She has no employment. She has no family. The only family was this gang who, in many ways, used her and continued to use her. And by the end of the novel, the climax, they use her to extremes.
Mm-hmm. She's very, very sad. Portraits of people, I must say. Well, and they seem so real and intimate, though.
I mean, because they are real to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, you know, I didn't make a conscious decision to say, I am going to be writing about the disenfranchised of the disenfranchised. But as these characters took on their lives, that's when I realized that I really had to open them up and allow them to tell their stories about where they lived and what they did and how they survive. And I think that for me, the foundation of this particular novel, again, goes back to this idea of people like my brother, people like my family, where my brother, who has this schizophrenic disorder, who will probably never get married, who will probably never have a relationship other than, you know, the sisters and the brother relationships.
And the caregivers.
And to have that, what James McConkie would say, that resistance not to die. Mm. Just to have that gold of each day, getting up and having the resistance not to die, I think has to be honored. It has to be honored and recognized. And so I don't see it out there. And so I decide I am going to do it, and that's what I do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had said that you started out writing about gang violence, and you ended up with a book about a community of people who have been dissected from themselves.
Right, right.
Talk to us a little more about that.
Yeah, you know, the way the novel began, I have to say, it was... it started out several years ago. My husband and I were visiting East Los Angeles, and we were sleeping over at my sister's house. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, there was gunfire going on, shootouts going on. And then, of course, right after that, the incredible sound of helicopters and the beams of light and everything else. And my husband, he turned, you know, he says, "My God, what's that? What's that?" You know, and I was half drowsy, so used to this type of stuff, that I said, "Oh, it's just gunshot." He says, "Elena, it's not gunshot. it sounds like a machine guns." I mean, it was really. And then what happened was that the next day, it made me realize how normal, how I accepted this, and how my sister and my family all accepted this. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, something is not right here.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elena Maria Vera Montes. She's a novelist. We're talking about her book, Their Dogs Came With Them. Now, in this book, there's an absolute sense that the characters, who most of whom were American citizens, were treated like foreigners in their own communities. That really struck me.
I mean, both my mother and my father were born in the U.S., and, you know, I have a great-grandfather who's buried in East Los Angeles. So I'm sure he came from Mexico, stayed here, and then he died, and he was interned there. So my roots go very deep into East Los Angeles, but you're absolutely right. We still are immigrants in our own land. I mean, I wrote an op piece for the New York Times, Summerscapes, on that very issue, where our family goes on this two-day vacation into Baja California, and how traumatic it was coming back.
Really?
Yeah, because you really don't understand it until you think about it and you reflect on it years later. But how passing from Mexico into the U.S., there was rigidity. My father and my mother are extremely nervous. There's, you know, the immigration officer looks at you as if you're already lying to
like
him.
Yeah, like you're guilty.
Yeah, like you know, and it passes on to us kids, and we know that somehow this is not right, you know. That's the way my parents have always felt, you know. That's why for me, when people talk about anti-immigration, what they're talking about really is people like myself, not only the undocumented worker, but also people who have been here for, 40, 50, 60 years.
Uh-huh. And
some
several
more,
generations.
And
yeah.
several generations, mm-hmm. and yet still be treated as if we do not belong here.
I want to ask you this. This book takes place from 60 to 1970. Has anything changed in East L.A. since that time?
Well, I think certainly the gang violence is still there, very, very much there. But it's gotten more high-tech and more bloody and more deadly, I think, than it was before. I think there was a certain amount of a romanticized vision of the gangs in the 60s, in the way of it, there being the outlaws, of there being the rebellion against a police state, so mm-hmm. to speak, mm-hmm. came into fruition mm-hmm. in during the Chicano moratorium uprising, where in fact it was the gang members who were protecting the community members from police. You know, it's been documented. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have this certain romanticized view to a certain extent of gang members during the 60s. But you get into the 70s and 80s and then into the 90s, and it becomes really, really, an organization of drug trafficking, and where there aren't any of these laws of the land anymore. Mm-hmm. But sort of outrageous violence. And this is what, in fact, made me start thinking about what kind of mentality are we being raised by that give us the capability to go out and kill without remorse mm-hmm. each other?
Exactly.
Each other.
But don't you think oppression does cause people to feel a lot of self-hate?
Well, of course, absolutely. And that's when I decided, you know, I had to look like 500 years back and look at the violent colonization of the Spanish with Mexico, and realize that when we have our colonized imagination, it is very hostile. It is very violent. There's a lot of self-hatred that is promoted, that is fed upon, that makes me very upset, that makes us really hate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Now, you have said that fiction is scripture to you, and that writing is the only way you know how to pray.
Yes.
To talk to us about that.
Well, you know, it goes back to my influences, and that was, you know, the oral storytelling and the whispering of adults. It went back to the encyclopedia, which I felt were the most beautiful books in the world and had all the information in the world, and the Bible. The Bible, who I felt had all the truth in the world. And so with these three influences, I really felt that every time I went to the library and I opened up a book and I read it, I realized that somehow I would get story, information, and truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the things that
those were empowering.
Incredibly yeah. empowering. And almost, I mean, I really feel a certain religiosity when it comes to reading, because I feel that we, the reader, have to have faith. We have to make that leap of faith. You know, I was raised Catholic, just like, you know, we believe in miracles. And how and what are those miracles, but are those things that happen without explanation? So we have to make that leap of faith. I think the reader and novels are the same way.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make that leap of faith.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1989, you were one of six writers chosen to work with the great Gabriel Garcia Marquez at Robert Redford's Sundance Institute. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Oh, my God.
It was an amazing experience.
It was an amazing experience. Well, you know what was so interesting is that year, for some reason, all the lights All the stars were aligned, because not only did I receive that, but before I received that, I received an NEA. And what I decided to do is pack up my two young kids and go to New Mexico, and I rented Robert Creeley's guest house.
The great poet.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And worked. Got up at 4 in the morning and worked until 12 or 1. And my good friend, who was an artist, also came with me, and she'd watch the kids. And then after I'd finish, then she would go on and do her work. And it was
great.
An incredible experience. When I get this call from the Sundance Institute saying that you've been selected, at first it was unbelievable, and I, you know, was thrilled. I was excited, and then they told me that I would have to make a presentation to Gabo on a story that I was working on, you know, because it was his goal to have all of us work out the storyline to write a script.
Mm.
So, but that I would have to do that in Spanish.
Really?
And that really, really took me aback, because, you know, I am, you know, the first 5 years of my life were, you know, were enmeshed in Spanish. But once I entered the Los Angeles school system, we were punished for talking Spanish.
Mm.
And so as a result, a lot of my generation, people like myself, can understand Spanish really well, but can't speak it.
Oh, you got intimidated.
Incredibly intimidated. So I refused. I said no. I wasn't. Piedad, who was the coordinator, said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Listen." And I gave her my spiel. I said, "You know, I hope that Gabo understands that, you know, in this country, this is what has happened. This is how our tongue was, you know, ripped from us, and that's why we can't speak Spanish." So she went to Gabo, apparently, and then came back the next day and called me and said, "Listen, Gabo wants, he says he understands English. So as long as he doesn't have to speak it, you can make your presentation in English."
Mm.
So I said, "Oh, wonderful. Okay. You know what? I still can't go." And she said, "What? Why?" And I said, "Because I have my two young kids." I mean, the fact
you
was...
You were afraid to go at first.
I was petrified. I was petrified to be in this situation with the great Gabriel García Márquez.
And he is
Can
a
you
legend.
Imagine?
Absolutely,
yes.
Yep.
And so then she went back and came back, and she told me, she says, "Gabo said, you know what, bring them. Bring the kids if you want." And so that's when I talked to my husband. I said, "You know what, I really should do this." Sandra Cisneros also told me at one point, "Are you nuts? Go! Go!" You know? And so I went, and it was the first time, of course, that I left my kids, but, you know, I was there for 10 full days where we had workshops from 9 until 12, and then we would break, and we would break for lunch and sometimes have lunch with him. And it was the most incredible experience. It's very hard to describe.
Mm. It must have been validating, though.
Oh,
among other things.
He loved my story. You know, it was so validating that when I left Sundance, I thought, you know what? I'm going to be a screenwriter, and I'm going to be successful. Well, okay, that didn't happen, you know. But I did end up writing a screenplay, which got produced by the American Film Institute.
Oh, well, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah, that was very exciting.
Now, I understand he also, some of the advice he gave you was, don't be a slave to convention.
He was very, you know, one of the things that he taught us, or at least that I came from, is this whole idea of pushing everything in the story, make it bigger than what it is.
Mm.
So that you then, in that bigness, there's possibilities that you can possibly use in that story. And always push, and look beyond not just what you have here in terms of plot line, in terms of character, but something always more than that.
Mm.
That's what I learned from him. And so I've been applying it to my work, as I hope, you know, you can appreciate.
Oh, absolutely. Now, is it true that you're now working on a screenplay again?
Or
you were, at least?
Well, I'm going to go back to the screenplay that I did develop at the Sundance Institute. And the only reason I'm selecting this for a screenplay is because it takes place in 1883. And, you know, to write a historical novel is something that really petrifies me.
Mm.
And so I'm thinking with the screenplay, I think I can play around with that a little bit easier by just saying, you know, 1883, and let other people think about that.
Uh-huh. And we are almost out of time. Can you tell us what the screenplay is about?
This is about Modesta Avila, who was the first convicted felon of Orange County, California. And the only existing photograph of her is one of her prison photograph that was taken in San Quentin. And I have a copy of the photograph that sits in my office. And it's an incredible story about this young woman who had a piece of land near San Juan Capistrano that was given to her by her father. And the Southern California Railroad was building a railroad track and just decided to build over her land. And so she complained to the authorities at that time. The authorities said, we can't do anything. She complained to the rail people who said, you know, you're crazy if we're going to pay. And so what she did as a protest is that she, legend has it, that she put a laundry line across the railroad tracks, which I think is, you know, an incredibly feminist image. And but they arrested her for obstruction of the railroad and tried her and acquitted her, but people didn't like that she was acquitted, so they retried her. And she was, in fact, convicted and sent to San Quentin, where at the time she was pregnant, and then we lose track of her. We don't know what happens.
Oh, this sounds like a very interesting subject.
Oh,
I hope you do follow through with
thank
it.
Thank you.
Elena Maria Viramontes, we have run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining me. And please, go out and buy Their Dogs Came With Them. It's an amazing experience. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.